University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Dr. Vera Kistakovsky, Professor of Physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, speaking on SDI and the scientist. Dr. Kistakovsky is past president of the Association for Women in Science and is an advisor to United Campuses to Prevent Nuclear War in its campaign to have scientists and engineers sign a pledge that they will not request or accept Strategic Defense Initiative funding.
We all know what a scientist is. A scientist is a person who works in a lab, isolated from the world outside. A scientist who is a person who is unconcerned about personal life. And lastly, of course, a scientist is a man. Well, all three of these myths is denied by the life of our forum speaker today, who is Dr. Vera Kistakovsky, who is a professor of physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She was educated at Mount Holyoke and the University of California, Berkeley. Her scientific specialties are experimental nuclear physics and now experimental particle physics. But she has also been very concerned about the role of women in the sciences, which she discussed last evening at a small symposium here at Wesleyan. And she has also been very concerned about nuclear armaments. She serves on the board of directors of the Council for a Livable World. This morning's talk is entitled SDI and the Scientists. Dr. Kistakovsky.
Thank you. The reason I think it's unfair is that that means that I've got to stop
your time,
and I will do my level best. The clock is not correct to accomplish that. Okay. What I'm going to talk about today, as you know, has its origins in a speech that was given by President Reagan on March 23rd, 1983. Let me find my beginning here. And I would like to quote to you some of the statements from that speech. I seem to have made a fine muddle of everything here, but I will get there eventually. But what if free people could live secure in the knowledge that their security did not rest upon the threat of instant retaliation to deter a Soviet attack, and that we could intercept and destroy strategic missiles before they reached our own soil or that of our cities? This was a very powerful message with a strong moral substructure, and it had great appeal to the American public. Further in the talk, he said something else. I call upon the scientific community who gave us nuclear weapons to turn their great talents to the cause of mankind and world peace, to give us the means of rendering these nuclear weapons impotent and obsolete. And what I'm going to talk about today is why there has not been this scientific crusade in response to President Reagan's call. Why, instead, there has been a very strong opposition from a large segment of the scientific community to the program that has resulted. And it includes not people like myself who have worked, only people like myself who have just worked in basic research, but it also includes many scientists who have worked in the weapons laboratories, on the committees appointed by the federal government to advise the weapons programs, people who have an intimate knowledge of what has happened in the past in this country in terms of weapons developments. In order to talk about this sensibly, I have to give you a little bit of background, because it isn't just purely a technical assessment that enters into the reaction to the proposal. It is also an assessment of what various implications of such a defense might be. The idea of a defense is not a new one. As a matter of fact, in the United States, the first suggestion for a defense against missiles was in 1946, when two think tanks The U.S. Thumper Project and the U.S. Wizard Project were set up to study the possibility of such a defense. And in 1956, we had our first ABM program, the Nike Zeus program. In the Soviet Union, the first public announcement came in 1967 when they said they would deploy an ABM, but clearly they started long before that. And the sequence of events that followed all of these activities were the ABM agreement in 72, followed by the protocol in 74, which limited the ABMs in both countries to one system. I should not use acronyms. ABM stands for Anti-Ballistic Missile System, and I will attempt not to use abbreviations from now on. I should also mention that there is another program which is very closely coupled to anti-ballistic missile defenses, and that is anti-satellite weapons. And those also are not a new development. In the United States, we started a program of testing anti-satellite weapons with nuclear warheads in 1963, which only ended in 1968 when the Limited Test Ban Treaty was signed. And the reason we signed the Limited Test Ban Treaty was the assessment that the weapons against the satellites were much more dangerous to our security than the ability to destroy them was a positive thing. The Soviet Union in 68 started testing non-nuclear chemical explosive anti-satellite weapons and have done it on a very relaxed basis ever since. So that's sort of the background history to defenses of one kind or another. The policy in this country, as I'm sure you know since the beginning, has been based on the idea that one will prevent nuclear war by threatening response to any attack that is unacceptable to the enemy. At first, we had what was called a massive retaliation policy, that if the enemy attacked, one would throw all of one's nuclear warheads at the other side. And in 1966, this was enunciated by McNamara as MAD. I blanked out on what it means. Mutually assured destruction. See, the initials really get in your way. But the whole idea was to prevent nuclear war, not to protect oneself from it. And coupled with this is the ability to know if the other side is going to attack you, and that's why the satellites are so very important, because if the satellites are destroyed, you will not have an early warning of an attack, and you will not be able to respond promptly. Let me say, however, although this has been the policy in this country, there has been another school of thought that has been very active all along, and that is that nuclear weapons are just another kind of weapon, and that one should investigate all the possibilities that might accrue from fighting with them, the nuclear war fighting school. And in fact, in the last 15 years or so, there has been a steady shift in that direction. In 1974, there was a national security decision memorandum that marked the end of the policy of massive retaliation and replaced it with a concept of limited nuclear war. That if attacked, instead of responding with everything you had, you would make a proportionate response and try to keep a nuclear war from escalating. In 1980, there was a presidential directive saying that the country should investigate the possibility of flexible and protracted nuclear war fighting capability, really using these weapons on a long-term war fighting scenario rather than envisioning a sudden attack that would be over. And then one would just assess the damages. In 1984, Reagan signed another national security decision directive, which describes something that is now called the strategic concept. And this represents a shift from a national strategy based on offensive weapons only to one based on both offensive and defensive weapons. Colin Gray, who is a theorists very much identified with the nuclear warfighting school, has said, one cannot have a warfighting approach to war planning unless one adopts a campaign perspective which takes full account of the damage that the enemy could inflict. Therefore, one must have defenses. The Reagan administration has said that it is convinced that it is possible to prevail in a nuclear war. That means that the United States could come out of such a war intact enough so that it would still be identifiable as the same society. And that has been one of the reasons for this radical change in our strategy and the introduction of a real role for defenses in our national armament. Let me say, there is, again, a very strong moral component to this. The strategic concept is very appealing because it takes us away from the very repugnant idea that we will slaughter a whole civilization in response to an attack. I don't want to belittle that aspect at all. It is something that has been devoted, has been discussed by many church groups, and a lot of thought has been devoted to what are the implications of making that kind of a threat of mass extinction. And it is also a very threatening situation to have this sword hanging over your head all the time, the threat of nuclear war. The nuclear freeze movement was born out of both of those feelings, coupled with the fact that the Carter administration started a new round of weapons building. And poll after public opinion poll indicated that the American public wanted an end to the arms race, wanted an end to the escalation, and was very much in favor of a nuclear freeze. The idea of a defensive system that will eventually permit the phasing out of nuclear weapons, therefore, has a very powerful appeal. And in fact, the Star Wars speech did very much completely arrest the nuclear freeze movement. Well, let me reiterate. The attraction of the Star Wars concept is that one will have a significantly strong defense so that the civilian population will not be damaged by a nuclear attack, and therefore one can do away with offensive weapons. And therefore, immediately when it was enunciated, the question of technical feasibility was raised. Now, President Reagan had not discussed his idea with his science advisor, let alone with the White House Science Council before he gave that speech. And apparently, as far as one can tell, he also did not discuss it with representatives of the Department of Defense. Consequently, there was a period of a couple of months of real confusion before the administration got its act together and really started to give consistent response to questions. And then details started to emerge, and it became clear that what was envisaged was a colossal effort. Richard DeLauer, who was then Undersecretary for Defense for Research and Development, said it was comparable to 8 Manhattan projects. The Manhattan Project was the project that built the first atomic bomb. Unlike the Manhattan Project, however, this was not taking a new idea, a new physics idea, and exploiting it to make a very crude weapon. It was taking ideas that had been around for a long time and stretching technologies by several orders of magnitudes to make very sophisticated weapons. And it is quite a different challenge to do that. The SDI, or Star Wars program, has also been compared to the Apollo project, putting the man on the moon. Again, it is not a good comparison. When you were putting a man on the moon, you were in conflict, if you like, with the laws of nature. But you had infinite confidence that the law of gravity was not going to change while you were taking that rocket up to the moon and while you were lowering the man down to the moon. Whereas in the case of building a defense, you are facing an enemy who clearly is going to change his strategy to counter whatever you are doing. And this is perhaps a very simple way of explaining why many scientists have come to the conclusion that a virtually perfect defense is impossible. And if you want me to elaborate on that, I will do that in the discussion period. I share that view too. Not that it is improbable, but that it is impossible. This resulted in criticism, as I said, from a wide spectrum of scientists. And the agreement, a stretch to the administration, for very rapidly the people in the administration ceased to talk about a civilian defense. And in fact, General Abramson, who is in charge of the SDI program, has said on any number of occasions that a nearly perfect defense is not possible, and has justified the Strategic Defense Initiative program instead in terms of its capabilities for a hardpoint defense, that is, a defense of missile silos. And, you know, usually the argument is if you get a defense that will destroy 80% of the incoming missiles, then you get such and such an advantage. And the other thing is that if you at the same time build up the number of offensive weapons you have, you then have a much more effective deterrent. Let me say, there is still argument about the technical aspects. People argue about whether it can be 50% or 80% or 95% effective, and it's not a negligible argument because there are profound implications for what, in fact, could be delivered. And I can recommend to you a document that does a very good job of discussing this aspect. It's a report prepared by the Office of Technology Assessment for Congress, which was published a year ago, and it goes into the implications of various levels of defense possibilities. It also says that a virtually impenetrable defense is impossible, and I believe the 80% figure that I mentioned comes from there as being a probable figure that could be achieved with a lot of effort. I mean, believe me, it is not a trivial thing to do that. Well, let me now tell you what I'm talking about. I'm sure you've seen pictures similar to this one, but let me show you a picture of a system based on SDI. Physics Today in 1983. Let's see if that improves it a little bit. No, I guess it is lack of illumination in the center. Or is it the screen? It's the projector. Okay. Well, this shows a space-based defense against ballistic missiles. Here the ICBM is launched, and it shows various kinds of weapons that could be used to destroy it, either in the first phase called the boost phase, or in any one of a number of sections of the mid-course phase, or the final phase, the reentry phase. And it shows an electromagnetic railgun, a chemical laser, a ground-based electron laser, an X-ray laser, and all of the weapons that you may have heard of in the press. I don't know if it shows any kinetic energy weapons. There's a neutral particle beam. Now, this is all lasers and particle beams. Added to this armory is now the possibility of kinetic energy weapons. These are a sort of state-of-the-art kind of weapon. And one of these was, in fact, used against a satellite a couple of weeks ago. And that is the kind of system that is being envisaged in this proposal. This was implemented first by setting up two study groups, the Fletcher Defense Technology Study Group and two study groups on the future security strategy of the country. This was in 1983. And these resulted in a proposal that, in fact, once set up what was in fact set up, the Strategic Defense Initiative, which was started in January of 1984. And it is a research, development, and demonstration program which is supposed to investigate and demonstrate by the early 1990s whether the kind of technologies which are envisaged could in fact yield a defense. Let me just show you a transparency which gives you a feeling for what has happened since then in terms of the budgets. In 1984, there was no SDI funding per se, but there were various programs in the Department of Defense, and they were less than $1 billion. In 1985, the first official year of SDI, SDIO stands for Office Strategic Defense Initiative Office, it was funded at $1.4 billion and another two-tenths of a billion for programs in the Department of Energy. This doubled in 1986, and the request for 1987 has another 75% increase in it. This is a crash program. It is technology limited. Money is supposed to be no object. One is supposed to try everything that might possibly lead to a result. There have been reports in the media of successes, but again, we can take a hard look at the claims and see what in fact they amount to. And I can recommend to you another report that deals with this. It's a report written by Senator Proxmire's office, which in fact deals with this question, and also with the question of whether the money has been well spent or whether this very rapid increase of funding is in fact wasteful. It also touches on the point that the program as it is now constituted is still based on the idea that one is going to be building a multi-layered defense of people and cities rather than what the claimed objective of the administration is, a defense of missile silos and perhaps a limited protection of the population. The argument then always is, well, it's just research and development. That's a benign thing. Certainly we want to do the research. We want to find out if this thing can work. Why not spend the money on it? We're a rich country. Why does it matter? Well, there are a number of reasons that people have given why they feel that this is inappropriate. And the first is an economic argument. It is a diversion of a considerable amount of money and talent from problems of the civilian economy and also from other weapon systems. And if one thought that this was going to be a very worthwhile thing, yielding something that was very important, one would be happy to do this. But given that there is certainly a division of opinion on that point, it is not clear that this is the route that one should go. Also, people frequently say, well, there will be all these spin-offs of the new technologies that are being investigated. Historically, spin-offs, that is, things that come out of military programs that can be used in the civilian economy, like, for example, Teflon, which I guess came from the Apollo project, are only sort of at the 10% level. If you want to develop Teflon, you don't have an Apollo project to do it. You spend 10% of the money to do that it took to develop it for Apollo to develop it for the civilian economy. And again, because it's a crash program, it is duplicative and very wasteful. There are also diplomatic problems. It's not just research and development. It's research, development, and demonstration. And there will, in fact, be a demonstration phase that in the mind of most people will violate the ABM treaty and will remove restraints on the Soviet Union, therefore. It also requires testing of nuclear systems because the X-ray laser is powered by nuclear systems. And it is the reason that our administration is not willing to sign the Universal Test Ban Treaty, which again is a block to reaching some kind of a diplomatic solution to the problem of testing. Finally, the third point is that because the way to penetrate the defenses that one can certainly rely on is to multiply the offensive weapons, it involves an escalation of the offensive weapons arms race in this country, but also in the Soviet Union. They have been quite clear that if we go forward with the defense initiative, they will not only try to emulate us, but they will also very much increase their stockpile of offensive weapons. I can show you what has happened in recent years in this country. And you can see this is the production of nuclear weapons. These are the warheads themselves. The figure has gone from less than 2 billion in 1978 to somewhat less than 7 billion in 1986. Another point is the one that I mentioned before, that the satellites are very important, not only important to early warning, but also important if we are going to get into a war-fighting situation. But principally, it is this consideration that if our means to observe the Soviet Union is destroyed, and if theirs to observe us is destroyed, that it is a very threatening thing for both sides. And we have, in fact, tested what is effectively an anti-satellite weapon, the space mine that was tested 2 weeks ago, under the name of being a strategic defense initiative component rather than a weapon. Congress forbade further tests on the anti-satellite weapon system that we have, and in fact this thing, which is different, was tested as an SDI component. Finally, there's the thing that hides in the current planning, which is that some defenses give the presumption that one is working to what is called a first strike capability, that one is working to the ability to launch an attack on the other side which will be sufficiently crippling to them that the weapons that they return to you, coupled with the defenses that you have, will prevent you from having unsupportable damage. And again, this is destabilizing. And these things also feed into the reactions by the scientists. And let me just show you what some of these reactions have been. More than 1,600 scientists at 26 government and 70 industrial laboratories signed a letter to Congress that was delivered in June of this year. And these include places like Los Alamos, Lawrence Livermore, and Sandia, which are the preeminent weapons laboratories in the country. The industrial laboratories include places like Boeing and Raytheon. Bell is really not an industrial laboratory. Lincoln Laboratory is not an industrial laboratory at all. They should have said private laboratories, not industrial laboratories. It is a private laboratory which is run by MIT. And the letter warned Congress that the Reagan administration is trying to boost Star Wars spending too quickly and thereby risking a significant escalation of the arms race. Another survey that was carried out of the National Academy of Sciences, a poll of its 1,500 members who are United States citizens. 36% of them responded. Of the 36 who responded, 92% answered that they were against the Star Wars program when asked, "What is your overall attitude towards the Star Wars program?" 4% were neutral, and 4% were for it. And all of these statistics always make a mention of how many Nobel laureates were involved in this. I think that's sort of irrelevant to the discussion. Another thing that happened last year, which is a little more interesting because it had more information than just a yes or a no answer, was that there was a poll carried out by Peter D. Hart Associates at the request of the Union for Concerned Scientists. Peter D. Hart Associates is a polling agency like the Gallup poll and has a very good reputation. The Union for Concerned Scientists is a special interest organization and therefore could not itself carry out the poll with any degree of credibility. And they asked a large number of questions of a randomly selected sample of members of the American Physical Society, and there's sort of a 4% confidence level on the results that were generated. And one of the questions were the perceptions of whether selected defense systems that might be developed represent a step in the right or the wrong direction for the nation's, for America's national security policy. And A 63% majority thought that the tridents were the right direction, and a 54% majority thought the Strategic Defense Initiative was the wrong direction. And you can see the other opinions on the cruise missile, the stealth bomber, Midget Man, and the MX. The MX also got a very strong, even stronger vote of no confidence, even though we're continuing to build it. I don't want to take too much time because of that deadline, a hard deadline. And so let me not show you all these transparencies. If people are interested, maybe we can look at them later. Let me just show you one more because I think it's very relevant. The question was, even if we can develop a system that works against today's weapons, the Russians can develop effective countermeasures. And if you take all of the physicists, 83% agreed and 11% disagreed. And that again comes back to the fact that this is not an Apollo project, this is dealing with an enemy that will react. Scrap this piece and go on. What I'd like to next talk about, again very briefly, and I'm sorry to be skimming over things so rapidly, but I think it's important to get a full background on this, is why there has in the last year been a very strong opposition to funding of university research by the Strategic Defense Initiative. Everything I've talked about so far has been generalized opposition to SDI. I now want to touch on a very specific topic. The funding of what is called mission-oriented basic research at the universities. Let me say there's a long history of funding of university research by the Department of Defense, and it stems from extremely good beginnings. The Office of Naval Research after World War II is still remembered by many scientists as the least string attached funding that they ever received. There really was funding for basic research. It was done on the basis of peer review, and it was an extremely good program for the universities. Other agencies had other programs which were not quite so free, but in fact there was a good component of basic research funding from DOD until the Mansfield Amendment in 1969, which said that if the military funds research, the research should have some relevance to military problems, which abruptly reduced DOD funding of university research. At MIT, it fell from 35% of all funding to 11% of all funding at MIT. And it had consequences on the Pentagon, which the Pentagon acknowledged. They missed the university scientists. They may have been a cantankerous, independent lot, but they had a lot of good ideas. And they were very good foil for the people at the weapons labs. I mean, you could bounce your ideas of them and they might point out traps in what you were trying to do. Another thing was that the doctorate scientists and engineers are produced at the universities. And if the research at the universities is not in the fields that are useful to the weapons program, that certainly is not going to produce a large crop of people who are obviously channeled for the problems that you are interested in. Therefore, long before SDI, there was beginning to be a drift for more DOD funding of university research. And this in itself is a question that one should address, but let's leave that for another time. In the fall of 84, there was a decision to establish a new office inside SDI, the Office of Innovative Science and Technology, and this was set up and is directed by Dr. James Ianson. At a meeting in 1985 in March, he introduced the program to a large group of university representatives, said they had a substantial amount of funding available for the coming fiscal year, described the program, and told how you could put in proposals to get the money. Let me just read you the purpose of the program from the briefing document that they gave. Actually, it's two purposes. The first is pursue from the scientific feasibility to the engineering proof of principle stage highly innovative, high-risk concepts that would have a revolutionary impact upon the Strategic Defense Initiative. B, mount a mission-oriented basic research program that drives the cutting edge of the nation's science and engineering effort in a direction that supports existing SDI technological development thrusts and points the way for future new initiatives. Please remember the phrase drives the cutting edge of the nation's science and engineering effort. The research that is to be supported by this program is in 17 fairly narrow areas. It's only a small fraction of the research that is done in this country. And it is a very highly structured program. On top, there are large consortia of universities, government, and industrial laboratories, weapons laboratories. The next layer down is a tier of research programs, big research programs, which have the potential for eventually evolving into consortia. And then at the bottom, there is an individual research grant division, but it is specifically for new ideas that don't fit into the two other parts and for programs which are approved too late in the year to be added to the other parts. It is intended as short-term funding. SDIO-IST is not intended for funding of small basic research grants. At many places, people went home from this meeting and didn't say very much about it. At MIT, initially, people like myself didn't even hear about the meeting. The way I heard about it was a graduate student in the Department of Nuclear Engineering said, "Have you heard about this meeting and seen the briefing document?" And I said no, and so she gave me a copy of the briefing document. But in other parts of MIT, those doing the research that might be funded under the program, there had been a discussion. At Cornell and the University of Illinois, there was a public announcement that this new source of money was available, and if people wanted to come to the person who was making the announcement, they could find out how to apply for research grants under this new source of money. And the result was that at both University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, and Cornell University, there was an immediate response from the scientists there and the start at both institutions of a discussion of what was going on, all the implications of taking this money, and a suggestion that people consider signing a pledge not to take the money. This spread very rapidly to other universities. There's an organization called UCAM, United Campuses to Prevent Nuclear War, which is an umbrella organization for campus groups that helped. Illinois and Cornell were both enormously active. And the result was that in May of last year, the results of the pledge drive were announced. More than 3,700 faculty and senior research staff had pledged not to solicit or accept SDI funds. More than 2,800 junior research staff and graduate students had pledged not to work on projects funded by SDI. Of these people, they were in 109 physical science and engineering research departments at 72 campuses, where 50% or more of the faculty signed the pledge. In this group, there were also people from the top 20 physics departments, and this is top here refers to research. I guess it also means graduate education because it's the Chronicle of Higher Education classification. And of the faculty in those departments, 57% of all the faculty combined have signed the pledge. Altogether, 110 campuses had such a discussion of the pledge, and these campuses include institutions which received 75% of combined Department of Defense and National Science Foundation funding in the country. So it is a very substantial fraction of the scientific community that is represented in that pledge drive. Well, You can ask, why did people sign the pledge? I've given a lot of reasons generally why people were not in sympathy with the Strategic Defense Initiative, but there are also some special reasons. The first one was that taking the research funding was and still is viewed as implicit support for a program with which some people disagree very strongly. If you disagree with the program and you still take the money, it will be interpreted that you support it. And let me say, that's not imaginary. Ianson said at that March meeting, it's probably something that's never been done, but this office is trying to sell something to Congress. If we can say that this fellow at MIT will get money to do such and so research, it's really something to sell. Let me say, that really hit home at MIT. President Gray, who has to balance being president of MIT with a very conservative group of alumni, took what was a quite courageous step for that particular position to say to the graduating class that year, among other things, what I find particularly troubling about the SDI funding is the effort to short-circuit the debate and use MIT and the other universities in an attempt to obtain implicit institutional endorsement. This university will not so be used. However, scientists recognize that those are nice words, but they don't represent the actual situation. The university has to sign contracts, and it does provide services, and it does take money in the form of overhead, and they are accepting something from the Strategic Defense Initiative. And the Strategic Defense Initiative office was very quick to point out that enthusiastic response to this research program would, in fact, be a very strong support for the program, and said, well, we've gotten more than 3,000 proposals. Isn't that a counter to the pledge effort? Unfortunately, Ianson added another of his memorable quotes to this, which may possibly have not had quite the effect he intended, which was that 2 second-rate scientists are as good as 1 first-rate scientist. I wonder what those people who sent those 3,000 proposals in thought about that particular quote. I mean, sometimes you don't need friends. Your enemies do it for you. He's not an enemy. He's a very nice young man. Misguided, but very nice young man. Another reason why there was a strong feeling against the university funding was that it was a distortion of basic research priorities. Because it is concentrated in such a very narrow set of areas at a time when other funding for research is decreasing. Let me just show you another one of my transparencies. In fiscal 86, which is October 85 through October 86, the Strategic Defense Initiative funding increased by 100%. Other military funding was supposed to increase by 16%, but dropped back to 8% because of Grand Rudman. Non-military funding of physical science and engineering went from 3% increase to 1% decrease. Life sciences went from a 5% decrease to a 9% decrease. The proposal for fiscal 87 was that the Strategic Defense Initiative increased by 75%, other military research increased by 20%, for a 25% increase in military-funded research and development. Non-military, no increase. And therefore, you come to the figure, which is the one that is usually quoted, which is that there is a 16% increase proposed for fiscal 87. This brings the military funding to 73% of the federal research and development funding budget. The coupling of this decrease in other fields with a massive infusion into a narrow amount of areas is a very serious potential distortion for basic research priorities. Well, Ianson has said that what is done at the universities is mission-oriented basic research. So let's again turn to a quote to see what he means by mission-oriented basic research. The difference is this. A basic researcher can get in his car and drive wherever he wants. A mission-oriented basic researcher gets in his car and goes to Florida, because we need to get to Florida. Whether he takes Interstate 95 or US 1 is his choice. Let me point out one of the problems with mission-oriented basic research is that we don't know whether we want to go to Florida. Another thing is that those 17 areas don't really represent the balance between Florida and the other 50 states. They represent perhaps a balance between Miami and all the other cities in the United States in terms of their importance to research in this country. And let me just say, it is my conviction and the conviction of many other scientists that the reason that the United States has such preeminence in basic research stems from the fact that we have been a society where free science can be done. It's subject to peer review, it's subject to restraints, but not on the basis that it's going to take you to Florida. On the basis that it's the best thing that you can do with the money, it will give you the best knowledge of the physical or the biological or whatever world that you can get. And it is no accident that this country is head and shoulders over the Soviet Union in science and most of the fields of technology. It stems from the fact that they have a closed, oppressive society, including their scientists, and we, in fact, have the possibility of exploring where our intelligence leads us. So much for the sermon. Let me go on. Another thing that is very frequently raised as an objection to the university funding is the possibility of restrictions on campus. In that briefing document, it says that principal investigators should get a security clearance, and they also recommend that at least some of the graduate students should, because of the coordination between the university programs and the weapons lab programs. There's also the possibility of classification. Ianson has said it will be treated as basic research. There's a memorandum from SDI on that subject. But the last paragraph of the memorandum leaves open the possibility that if the program develops in the direction that requires it, it will in fact become classified. And since a lot of the research will be done together with the weapons laboratories, this is not an idle possibility. And for an institution like MIT, which says that it will think very seriously before it allows classified research on campus, or an institution like Cornell that says it will not allow classified research on campus, this poses a real dilemma in accepting money for such research. Even if it doesn't become classified, many of these areas are what are called sensitive areas research under a set of acts and orders, which permits restrictions on their publication and also mandates that foreign nationals be excluded from a discussion of the results and participation in the programs. And I understand here in Nebraska that's not very much of a problem, but at a place like MIT, where we have a sizable component of foreign graduate students, it would have a very direct impact on our graduate education program. Most recently, there has also been a new wrinkle that has been put in. When I talked to people about the pledge at MIT, I got some people who were not willing to sign it because they were afraid of future consequences. I had nobody, literally nobody, who said to me, I think this is a wonderful program, I'm going to do the research because I think it is important to national security. There were obviously a lot of people who didn't sign the pledge, and there were a variety of reasons, but that was one that was never given me. One that was given me was a worry about future consequences of having signed the pledge, and in fact that seems to have materialized. Donald Hicks, who is now Undersecretary for Defense for Research and Development and therefore is the boss of the SDI program, was quoted as saying, if the opponents want to get out and use their roles as professors to make statements, that's fine, it's a free country. But freedom works both ways. They're free to keep their mouths shut, and I'm also free not to give them money. Subsequently, there was an uproar, including the president of the American Physical Society, Sid Drell, who is not the flaming radical. Believe me, he is center of the road man, very sensible, nice man, but definitely center of the road man. And Hicks was asked again whether he had meant what he said, and he said yes, he had been correctly quoted. But what I said is not DOD policy, and probably never will be for political reasons. I was just explaining what I would do, but I don't have final say in any of this. I don't have total control. However, he said that he will recommend internally that no Pentagon funding be provided to vocal SDI critics, and, quote, that may carry some weight. If your boss says that, I would imagine it would carry some weight. Finally, let me say, it does have an effect on graduate education. Graduate students get educated, in physics at least, where there is support for their research. And if the support is mainly in a narrow range of SDI fields, or not even mainly, but heavily weighted in that direction, you will get students who are competent in those fields. And it will have implications for the next generation of science in this country. Let me close by just telling you what happened this summer. Congress initially were sheep on the SDI issue. They just rubber stamped what the administration suggested. Last year, there started to be a small sign of discussion, but there still was uncertainty about whom they should believe. And they split the difference between what the president requested, $3.6 billion, and holding the budget constant at $1.6 billion. This year, after the impact of all the criticism, the House voted this summer to keep the budget at constant dollars, which is rather than the 75% increase that the administration wanted, and the Senate voted a 25% increase. And there is sign that, in fact, there will be some restraints on the increases on the program. And let me stop there.
Today, University Forum has presented Dr. Vera Kistikovsky, professor of physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, speaking on SDI and the scientist. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private, undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.